Good evening, everybody. We are going to do two avtoras this evening. I really appreciate that everybody was so kind last week and didn't point out to me that Parshas Vayeshev wasn't going to be read this Shabbat, that Shabbos. But I just wanted to do Amos because the avtora of Amos for Vayeshev is just such an extraordinary piece of work. So I didn't want to lose the opportunity to learn Vayeshev. I also don't want to lose the opportunity to learn the Hanukkah Haftorah, in addition to learning the Miketz Haftorah. So I sent out three pages today, and the Miketz Haftorah is going to be on the third page. But before that, I'd like to have a little bit of enjoyment here with the Hanukkah Haftorah. And you can imagine that the more you see things like Haman min HaTorah Minayin, Mordechai min HaTorah Minayin, Esther min HaTorah Minayin, Vashti min HaTorah Minayin, because Gemara in Maseches Chulin, not Megillah, but Chulin, that tries to find all kinds of hints to the Purim story in somewhere in the Torah. So the reason for this is because when the story of Purim had a lot of trouble being canonized, Gemara says in Daf Zayin in the Maseches Megillah that Mordechai and Esther had a really tough time convincing the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah that this story deserved to be included in the Tanakh. So when it finally got there, finally it was considered canonical, the forces that were against it being included, and those forces, I must tell you, continue to exist even into the Talmudic times. So when the forces continued to feel that Esther does not belong in the Tanakh, so the other side had to sort of, go with Nimishuris Adin to show how significantly you'll find hints of Purim in the Torah. Well, the same is true even more so about Hanukkah. The observance of Hanukkah did not catch on immediately. Okay, the book of Maccabees, it's also called Sefer Hashmonaim, and even the hint in the Gemara that says my Hanukkah, it says Lashana Acheres. They didn't observe the commemoration immediately. It just stood slowly. Caught on, and then Lashon HaAcheres, not Lashon HaBa, but some other year, it was sort of canonized not only as in the story, but also in the observance. Of course, by that time, the canon of Tanakh was closed, so the story of Hanukkah obviously could not be enshrined in the canon of the Tanakh. Although I must tell you that in some Christian Bibles, the book of the Maccabees 1 and 2, and there's also a 3 and 4, are included in some versions of the New Testament. Okay, they call it the Apocrypha. Right? The apocryphal books do not make it into the Masoretic text, of course. Okay, the closest you get to Chazal's use of these books is called Mishlei Ben Sira, which the Talmud quite generously quotes from. There's a Tosfos Ne'erovin of Samachay that collects a lot of these quotations in one place. Okay, so that's my introduction, that there is this desire to show that the Hanukkah story is somehow hinted in the Torah itself. And this became a polemical issue because in the 8th century, 9th century, 10th century, when the Karaites were gaining great political strength and great, they had quite the popular appeal amongst Jews, and they had the favor of the Muslims some generations. So when they denied all oral tradition. There's also a book recently came out the last 50 years called Karaism and the Judean Scrolls, which attempts to show that the Tzedukim and the Karaites are nothing but the natural progression from what we read in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I tell you that because the Dead Sea Scrolls despised the Hanukkah story. They left Jerusalem to go to the Dead Sea, to Qumran, to escape the Hashmonaim. Okay? An interesting twist, the Chasam Sofer says that the reason why you don't find a specific Mishnayis that is dedicated to Hanukkah is because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the author of the Mishnah, was descended from King David, and he considered it a breach that the Hashmonai Kohanim ruled as kings in Israel. They shouldn't have. And if, I'm sure you know your history from Aristobulus and John Hyrcanus, when they started to appeal to the Romans for their assistance, things went south very quickly amongst the Hashmonai rulers. Okay. So I believe that the word Hashmonaim, it means they're descended from a man named Hashman. There happens to be a place called Hashmona in the Torah. There's a place called Hashmona today, but whether that's the same as the place in the Torah is questionable. So here, let me start off with some cute little things. You might have heard of some of these. Take a look at the top of page one. In the bracha of Levi in the Torah, right, it's a very long bracha in the Parshas Vezovos HaBracha. In Vayechi, he doesn't get much of a bracha at all. But in Vezovos HaBracha, Moshe gives Levi, his own tribe, quite a bit of a bracha. And at the end, he says, Borech Hashem Chelo, may God bless the army of the Levites, Ufoal Yodov Tirtzeh, and may God find the workings of his hands to be pleasing to him. Machatz masnayim kamav. May he smite the trunk of his enemies. Umisanov min yukumun, so that his haters cannot rise. So Sadigon says, and it's the note two, the bottom there. The note two says that who's the army of Levi would be the Hashmonaim. When else did we ever have an army comprised fully of Levites? It was the Hashmonaim. The rebellion was started by Matisyahu as a Kohen, and his followers were Levium. But now here's the kicker. It says, and he smites the trunk. The Masnaim is the midsection. How do we know that that's a reference to Greece? Anybody? Why would the midsection refer to Greece? Charlie, you know?
From Daniel?
Yes. Yes, beautiful. From Daniel's the dream in Sefer Daniel, where the different parts of the body represent different nations in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The trunk was Yavon. Okay. So excellent. Okay, so when it says, may God bless the army of the Levites to smite the trunk of the enemy, there you go. There's a hint to Hanukkah right there in the Torah. Okay, that's probably the most serious of all the hints. Everything else you get now is like Shalashuvah's Torah. For instance, Hanukkah takes place on the 25th of Kislev. Right? They say that it stands for Chanu Chofhei. They rested from the battle on the 25th, right? Didn't have a chance to observe Sukkot that year, it says in Sefer Hashmonaim. So they decided to celebrate 8 days of Sukkot afterwards. The Book of Hashmonaim makes quite a big deal about the battle, but says nothing about a cruise of oil. The same is true about Al HaNisim in our prayers and in our benching. Nothing about oil. What's interesting is that the exact opposite is true about the Gemara. When the Gemara speaks about my Hanukkah, it mentions the oil, but says nothing about the battle. Okay? Maybe we'll have something to say about that towards the end, or I may just talk about it on Shabbos. Okay, the name of the holiday, however, this is nice drash, is much more readily connected to the word chinuch, Chanukah is a Mizbeach. Right? We were Mechanech the Mizbeach, the altar. Okay, it's a good question to ask, why is the observance of the renewal of the second temple after it fell into such disrepair, why do we celebrate that renewal in only one way? By lighting a candle. The renewal involved bread that could now be served on the Shulchan, so we should serve 12 breads on Chanukah. It involved the incense, which could now be brought, so we should bring incense on Chanukah. You get my picture here? It involved the renewal of the libations and the sacrifices. There are 100 things that were renewed. So why is it only the menorah that is commemorated? That will have to do with the Haftarah. Okay? So the word chinuch means to put to good use. That's what we do when we educate a child. We put that child to use. Right? However, the number 25 came to be so inextricably tied to Hanukkah that here's what I would like to share with you and now enjoy. Did you know that the 25th word of the Torah is... Anybody know? Or. Okay. So for the 25th journey we took in the desert was to a place called Chashmona. Uh-huh. All right, so that's just getting started. There's so many 25s that are connected to Parshas Miketz. Now that's disingenuous of me this year to do this because this year it's Parshas Vayeshev that's connected to Hanukkah, not Miketz. So it says in source number 5 that when Yosef came with his brothers in Parshas Miketz, it says Utvoach Tevach Vehochtein. See source number 5? Utvoach Tevach Vehochtein. You see that? I put a little box around those words. So there's no doubt that the Ma'oz Tzur takes its first line from here. Leis tochin matbeach, when God had prepared the slaughter, right? Mitzor hamenabeach, right? Leis tochin matbeach comes right out of these words of the Torah. And look at the phrase, utvoach taboch, include the chet and the last and the next word. You see what word you get?
Hanukkah.
You get Hanukkah there, right? Ches, vav, hey, chaf, nun. Right? You see Hanukkah spelled there? Okay. But, so that could be a nice coincidence, but the author of Ma'oz Tzur, no doubt, took his inspiration for that line from this pasuk. Number 6, it says that Yosef gave 5 hands, Hamesh Yodos, to Binyamin more than the other brothers. So there are 5 hands in Alanisim. Ibarim biyad chalashim, rabin biyad me'atim, tmeim biyad tahorim, shayim biyad tzadikim, zedim biyados ketarasim. So there are 5 biyads, there are 5 yodos. And how many fingers are in 5 hands? There's your 25 again. Source number 8, this is an interesting thing. This must be done with intention. At the end of each parsha, there is what's called a siman to tell you how many psukim are in that parsha. Right? You know what I'm saying? Like, there's only one whose siman is actually the name of the parsha. Tzav. Tzav has 90. Tzav's siman is Tzav. Huh. But that's anomalous for another reason. Tzav is the only one that's wrong. There are actually 97 psukim. 96 took him in 2 other parashios whose siman is not Tzav, but Tzav's siman is Tzav. There's another one where the siman is the last word in the parsha. Parsha's Vayetze is Machanayim. Vayetze is the word Machanayim. Parshas Miketz is the only parsha that tells you not only the amount of psukim in the parsha, but the amount of words in the parsha. No other parsha tells you the amount of words in the parsha. So Parshas Miketz tells you that there are 2,025 words in Parshas Miketz. That's a lot. 2,025 words in Parshas Miketz. Why do I care how many words are in the Parsha? See the amount of Pesukim? Okay, if Balkori wants to know. Why the amount of, and why only Miketz? Have you heard the answer to this?
Roger.
Right, because 2,025 is the Gematria Ner, 250 times 8, there are 8 candles, plus 25, back to Hanukkah, back to the Chafei. Right? Okay, we're going to start to get a little more serious now. Look at sources number 9, A, B, C, and D. Source number 9, everyone see it? So, the Haftorah of Parshas Baha'aloscha, page 2, source number 9 in the middle of the page. The Haftorah of Parshas Baha'aloscha, which is the main feature of that Parsha, which has many topics to it, is the beginning, which is talks about the menorah. It happens also to be the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah. And we read from Zechariah chapter 3 and 4. And Zechariah is shown a number of visions that confound him. Okay, I think I discussed some of Zechariah's visions before, right? Zechariah has 13 visions, each one a little more cryptic than the other. And Zechariah is shown a what seems to be a fantastic vision of a menorah which has what appears to be hundreds of tubes flowing from two olive trees, with two, some commentary, 7 times 7 times 7 tubes that are emanating from the corners of the trees into an overflowing menorah that has a never-ending supply of oil. Zechariah looks at this vision, and he's not clear of what it means, right? The angel explains to him that the two trees are the Shnei B'nei HaYitzhar. This is actually source number 11 because it's right after the Haftorah. The Haftorah ended Shuos Chein Cheinla, but this continues right afterwards. Okay. And Hashem shows him these two trees, the Shnei B'nei HaYitzhar. Two sons of oil. Who would be B'nai HaYitzhar? You see, the Tanakh has some very, very contradictory pictures of the messianic personality. Somewhere he's very old, somewhere he's very young, somewhere he's very poor, somewhere he's very glorious, somewhere he was rejected, somewhere he's accepted. So Christianity deals with this dichotomy by referring to two different comings. Judaism has to deal with it also. So what's our answer? It's not two different comings, rather it's
what?
Two different Mashiachs.
Different Mashiachs, Ben Yosef and Ben David.
Right. The first is Ben Yosef, the second is Ben David. There are different traditions about how they work together. It is not a very formulated topic in Chazal, but thanks to one of our greatest thinkers of our history, he has written quite a bit about it, and he was very intrigued by it, and established some very interesting shittos about what Mashiach ben Yosef represents. Of course, I'm referring to the Vilna Gaon, who sent his Talmidim to Israel to become the Mashiach ben Yosef. He felt that Mashiach ben Yosef was like a movement. And everybody who goes to Israel to prepare the arrival of Mashiach ben David has a share in being Mashiach ben Yosef. And they are the two trees. And the reason why they're called Mashiach is because they have oil anointed on their head. Right?
So it is a metaphor. It is just a metaphor, ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef. Nothing. Nothing substantial.
Well, I would say the simplest shot of all these prophecies, like in Yechezkel, the Haftorah Vayigash that we're getting next week, Some other Nevi'im were referred to the two leaders. It's simple. There were two kingdoms in Israel.
Right.
One from a descendant of Yosef, that was the northern tribes, commonly called Ephraim, Haben Yakili Ephraim, or just called Yosef sometimes, often called Israel, the northern tribes. And then, of course, you had the descendant of David, who was the king in the southern kingdom. So just as in Sefer Melachim you had two kings, so too in the future we'll have two kingdoms, but only one the two Mashiachs, but only one will actually rise to be the king.
But Yosef was the first one who came to Egypt and prepared, as if prepared.
Yeah, I'd say that, yes, Yosef. So Yosef prepares for the redemption. To be sure, Chazal say that Yaakov also sent Yehuda ahead, Goshna, right? And of course, beautiful Tanchuma that points out that the gematria of the word Goshna is exactly Mashiach.
Ah,
right. So Goshna was that Mashiach comes on the heels of preparing that you have a separate place, that you don't assimilate. Assimilation is Mashiach's worst enemy. Assimilation chases away Mashiach, as we're about to see in the Haftorah, right? Okay, because that's what I said before about that the observance of this Chanukah Sabayis should involve oil, because oil does not mix. It's symbolic, but oil does not mix. Right? I'm taking the Goshna to set up a base medrash so you don't assimilate. Right? Goshna happens to be, this is just Bederach Tzachos, the four letters that you find on a dreidel, if you're in Chutz Laaretz, at least. We might have more of an impetus to make sure we don't assimilate. So the Haftorah begins with the personage of the Kohen Gadol, Yehoshua HaKohen HaGadol. And he is wearing putrid, disgusting clothing, and he's standing before the king, the angel. You see, Pasukim will be Yehoshua Hayo Lavush Begodim Tzoim VeOmed Lifnei HaMalach. Hayan VeYamer Alamdim Lefanav LeMor Hasira Begodim Hayo Tzoim Me'Alav. Remove those disgusting garments from the Kohen Gadol. You shouldn't be dressed like this. Put them on more covetous clothing. Now, there are different opinions over what these disgusting clothes represent. It could be, like Ibn Ezra says, that it represents the fact that the beginning of Bayis Sheni did not actually realize the promise that Haggai and Yirmiyahu and the end of Yishayahu predicted what would attend to the Beis HaMikdash when it would be rebuilt. Gedol Yeh Kivod HaBayit Hazeh Acharon Min HaRishon. But the people didn't put their full energies into it. These prophecies weren't what would be, but what ought to be if the people put in their energies. So remove the disgusting clothing and make a better effort. That's Ibn Ezra. Rashi, however, cites the Medrash that the disgusting clothing represents the fact that the Kohen Gadol's own sons had intermarried. How do I know that? Where do I know that? So if it was a medrash, I could still cite a medrash, but it's not a medrash, it's a pasuk. Okay, the assimilation got so bad that Nehemiah and Ezra had to publicize the intermarried men. And amongst the intermarried men were Yehoshua Kohen Gadol's two sons. Right? So it's an expression of the assimilation. I didn't need this point in Zechariah to know that there was assimilation in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Malachi also speaks about the intermarriage. We read about that a few weeks ago, remember? Where we connected Esav's marriage to the two Hittite women, to that element of Malachi. Right? Remember we talked about that just a few weeks ago. Okay, so that's the first thing. The removal of the Kohen Gadol's putrid garments is a hint to the rampant assimilation of the day. Then, Hashem, the Navi refers to Avdi Tzemach. You see the underlined portion in Pasuk Ches. Avdi Tzemach. He's my servant Tzemach. Now, Tzemach is not a new name. Yirmiyahu mentions Semach Tzadik and Semach Tzedakah, chapter 23 and chapter 33. Ze Asher Yikro Hashem Tzidkenu. It's a name. It's a name that that God gives to the messianic personage. Why Tzemach of all things? Because his arrival is a tzmicha. Mashiach's arrival is not something that's just going to fall from heaven. I'm afraid that sometimes I think the Satmar and then the Turi Karta feel that way. Right? There's a very popular picture on the streets of Bnei, of Me'e Sha'arim, of some four or five Gedolim looking up at the sky in awe at a Beis HaMikdash that's being lowered down to Har HaBayis by angels. Right? Maybe that's the most realistic approach that you could have about how the Beis HaMikdash could possibly ever be rebuilt. But it's certainly not the Rambam's approach, I'll put it that way. Okay, it's Rashi's approach. Rashi says all over his writings that the third Beis HaMikdash will be built in a day by God. By God, not by man. Okay? Be that as it may, I'm suggesting otherwise here, that the Messianic arrival is at Tzmicha. That's why we refer to it, religious Zionists do, as Reishis Tzmichas Geulaseinu, the first sproutings of our redemption, right? And why we pray in Shemoneh Esrei, Es Tzemach David Abdecha. Okay, so he refers to this Tzemach who will inspire the Jews to be a Kiddush Hashem, to be a light unto the nations. Okay, Bav Torah continues, look to the left, to the right. Bav Torah continues with this menorah that has an everlasting supply of oil to it. Now, when Zechariah looks at this fantastic sight, he says, God, what is this? Well, I don't know what it is. And God then goes on to describe it. And he says, now, Zechariah, explain it to the people. And he says, I don't know how to explain this to the people. It doesn't make sense. What is it? The reason why Zechariah couldn't know what it means is because it hadn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. Prophecy for the future about a never-ending supply of oil is even when you think that you ran out of oil, it's there for you. Okay. I in fact, is the Pnei Yoshua asks the famous questions, why did they even need this miracle? Tumahutra b'tzibur. Right? You know what I mean? You know what that means, right? When everything is tamei, that's all you have, use it. It's like a Pesach rule. It's you can do everything with a tumah if that's all you have. But the Pnei Yoshua asks about five or six different subsidiary questions like that. And I would just say that, if I may be so bold, not to chas v'shalom, undo the great Pnei Yoshua, because he's really one of the really great, greatest of the Achronim, is that when the Gemara says that Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, it does not mean Tumas Avodah Zarah Hutra B'Tzibur. It means Tumas Meis Hutra B'Tzibur. Tumas Sheretz Hutra B'Tzibur. Tumas Nida Hutra B'Tzibur. But not Tumas Avodah Zarah. Okay? How do I know from the Gemara that there was Tumas Avodah Zarah on the oil? Remember what the Gemara says? It uses the lashon asher shiktsu hayavana. Sheket shikt the shaktenu. That's the word the Gemara uses for avodah zarah. So they were like sanctified avodah zarah. So that is not hutra b'tzibur. Okay, be that as it may, it's just a halachic side point. So then at the end of this haftorah, Hashem tells Zerubbabel, the political leader, who's in charge, the political leader is in charge of making popular decisions and gathering the people, because there's going to be a war to be fought. And he says, in this war, lo b'chayo v'lo b'koach, you will not fight this war with numbers. You will not fight this war with chayo and not with might. You will fight this war with the Spirit of God, and the few will defeat the many, and Zechariah doesn't know what's flying. What is all this? Assimilation, the Kohen Gadol's sons, a never-ending supply of oil, the few defeating the many. Chevra, I submit to you, here is the perfect haftorah for Hanukkah. Right? There's every element of the holiday. Okay? Make no mistake, the holiday was catalyzed by assimilated Jews who made a deal with the Greeks. You accept us, You allow us to join your country clubs. You allow us in the gym with you. You allow us in the academy with you. You allow us in the symphony with you. And we will assure that we no longer will circumcise our males. We'll spread the word. We'll stop those kikey holidays where the Jews take off early on Fridays. Right? So that was the first movement. Well, it was not necessarily totally initiated by Antiochus. According to the Book of Maccabees, the Jews were some of the catalysts in this, right? Okay, so comes Zechariah to say that never-ending supply of oil will always serve you in good stead and assure that the holiday can exist. You see, I wrote on the side number 10, right, that never-ending supply of oil exists in a cup called Ve'gula. You ever hear of the connection of this word to Hanukkah? Ve'gula. Vav Gimel Lamed Hey. Okay, well, you would have gotten, I didn't get any this year, but I used to get three or four of them every Hanukkah. These little boxes of the colored candles. Did anybody get them this year?
What kind of candles?
You know, those little boxes. They're about 3 inches tall. And, you know, those are smaller boxes.
Oh, right.
Yeshiva sends them to you and with an envelope, right?
No,
anybody have those little boxes there they can show? We have some in the drawer inside there. So they last a half hour, just enough time. So the gematria of the word vigula is 44. Camellia, is that it? Yeah, Camellia is holding one. Yeah. You see it?
Uh-huh.
Right, you got it in the mail or you bought it?
I bought it from Seasons. These are it?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh.
Yeah, so but they used to send them in the mail, fundraisers. Anyway, so that has 44 candles altogether, which is the gematria of Vigula, right? In other words, the receptacle that Zechariah says that's going to contain all this oil has the gematria of the amount of candles we use on Hanukkah. Wow. Okay, so that those are your two B'nai HaYitzhar, right? And Chinuch means to put to good use, right? Let's see how Haftoras Miketz puts itself to good use here. This is probably one of the most famous stories of Sefer Melachim. Everybody knows the story, right? And it may not even be the main point of the Haftorah. I think it is, but because the Haftorah begins with the words Vayikatz Shlomo v'hinei chalom. You get it? Vayikatz, he woke up. Shlomo woke up and he saw it was a dream. So forget about the fact that there is that Vayikatz sounds a lot like Miketz, right? He woke up, sounds like Miketz, right? But Vihine Chalom. So the Torah reading begins with a dream and the Torah begins with a dream. Okay. Now that in itself shouldn't be enough because there are other dreams in the Nevi'im, right? This is not the only dream in the Nevi'im. So what is it about the story? Let's read it, please. It's a short Haftorah. Okay. First, let me tell you the content of the dream. Is where God comes to Shlomo as he ascends the throne. And he asks him what he wants. Shlomo seems to be a young lad. Because I'll say he's only 12. Let's give him up to 17, but he's not mature and old. Okay, old meaning like even in his 20s. So God comes to him in a dream and asks him, Shlomo, what do you want to assure the success of your kingdom? So Shlomo says, God, your people are such a diverse people. Sounds like what Moshe said, remember in Parshas Pinchas? Right? It's the Rashi, number 15 on page 3. Okay. God, you have every Jew has to be treated differently. Every Jew is a whole different picture. Every child is. So appoint a leader who will appreciate the need to treat every Jew as an individual. So Shlomo says something similar. And he says, God, what I would ask of you is the wisdom to judge your people properly. Okay? So God tells Shlomo, what a wonderful thing you asked. You could have asked for riches. You could have asked for your enemies. You could have asked for long life. You could have asked for anything. Because you asked for wisdom, I will give you significant wisdom, and I will give you all those things you didn't ask for. What's interesting is that the pasuk repeats all the things God just mentioned, except long life. Okay?
How long?
However old Shlomo is here, he lived only 40 years more. So Chazal say he died at 52. But then God gave him all those other things. Right? He was the son-in-law of practically every king in the world. Right? It's probably his pshat. The Rambam insists he converted all his wives. Okay, but since I mentioned son-in-law, there's a cute son-in-law joke that I want to tell you that makes light of this Haftorah. The story is about two families that each paid $10,000 to an unscrupulous shadchan who set up two different daughters from two different families with the same best boy in Lakewood. And then she disappeared. So the two families were fighting it out. Who gets the boy? Right? Each one wanted this wonderful boy for their daughter. Right? So they took it to a din Torah. And the rabbi saw that, you know, each one has an equal case. Each one paid $10,000. No one was aware of the other one. And he was baffled. It says very clearly in Bava Metzia and Choshe Mishpat that when two people have an exactly the same, you can't do Yehemunah Chachiva Eliyahu. I don't want to do Shuda the Dining. I'm not going to say Kol Da'alim Kvar. I'm not going to say, you know, I have to say Yachloku. I'm not going to say Yehemunah Chachiva Eliyahu. He has to marry someone. You know, so he said, Yachloku, cut them in half. Half for this woman, for her daughter, and half for that woman, for her daughter. So the first woman says, no, I can't be part of that. Such a thing. This is insane. Cut a boy in half because of this unscrupulous shadchan? No, I'm out. Give the whole boy for her daughter. I'm finished. A brach to the money. So the second woman says, no. If that's the halacha, that's the halacha. You cut the boy in half for her daughter, half for me, for my daughter. So the rabbi looks at the second woman and says, give the boy to that woman for her daughter. She's the true mother-in-law. Jenny, you don't find that funny?
No.
Okay, So this is the famous story where Shlomo tries to determine the true mother with his chachmah. Now, the fact is, I've often asked anybody to please recreate the scenario, and no one ever gets it. No one ever gets it. Right? Because let's analyze the situation, right? Two women are in court. What does each woman want? She wants to walk out with
a baby.
But also that everybody who is in the court that day recognizes that this is my baby, and the other one is the one who killed her baby, right?
Yeah.
In other words, there's a dispute here, right? Each one wants the baby, right? So if you came to court wanting the baby, right, what made you satisfied to get half a baby?
Only vengeance to the other woman.
Could be. But it's, remember what these two women did for a living, right? Need I say?
No.
Okay. They don't want to be saddled down with a baby, but okay. But, all right. They,
oh.
They, such as what they have, but all right, not that they're not going to commit infanticide, but so, you know, you could have just said, okay, I'm sorry to say, this is my baby, I smothered it, goodbye, and now let's go on. But no, she wants to implicate the other one, right? So what is the order of the events in the court? Because everybody always assumes that when Shlomo gave his psak, right, his halacha, so to say, that, you know, he said that everyone gasped, right? Everyone is like, I can't believe that. How could he do such a thing? And then the fake mother said, okay, that's what we should do. Yeah, okay, let's do that. And then the real mother said, no, please, I would rather at least see him live than to see him, even if it means I don't get to have him. But that's not the order of things. The real mother first said, like in the joke, the real mother said, I don't want to be part of this. Give the child to the other. At that point, what should that woman have done?
Accepted it.
Accept. That's why otherwise why are you in court? Mm-hmm. Right? What did she mean cut the baby in half and have a half a baby? How's that? So Shlomo. So here's the thing. Is that the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin says that Shlomo was actually able, maybe by checking the pulse, but he was able to look into the eyes of people and tell if they're telling the truth. He didn't need testimony. But he worked with testimony because that's the halacha, you never work with testimony. But he always knew. And the chachma was that he knew in advance how this was going to end. Of course, he wasn't going to kill a baby. But he did make a full room of gasping Israelites consider that he would. And this is really where I submit to you is his undoing. There is another place where Shlomo's father says to cut something in half that made Chazal very upset. Camille, you know?
Field.
Right.
The field. The vineyard.
Correct. The field, it was more than just a vineyard, but it was a field that originally belonged to Shaul, the first king of Israel. And when the new king comes in, whatever the old king owns becomes the property of the new king. But Shaul remembered a pact that he had forged with his best friend Yonatan, and he found a child of Yonatan who was hiding. Yonatan mistakenly felt that David would want to kill him, so he was in hiding. And David said, "You don't need to be afraid. I'm going to support you." And he gives him a tremendously a lucrative plot of land with lots of servants. He gives him 35 servants, and now that plot of land is near the central bus station in Israel, in Yerushalayim, and David lived in the old city. So it's not there was a paved road at that time. It was called Rehov Yaffa then too. And it was the road that went straight to Yaffa. So if you just go up the central bus station, you'll get to the old city. You'll get to Rehov Yaffa. Right? Get to Machane Yehuda, you'll get to it's a pretty straight line. So how often, and David invited him anytime he wants to be his guest at the palace. Right. So remember, he had a certain defect. He was lame. He was crippled. Right. So during the time of Avshalom's revolt, this child, his name was Mephibosheth. This child remained in Yerushalayim. It's true that if you remained in Yerushalayim, it meant you sided with Avshalom. If you sided with David, you followed David over the Yarden. But Mephibosheth remained in Yerushalayim not because he sided with Avshalom, but because he was crippled and he couldn't leave. So when the revolt was finished, and David was not in a very good mood because Avshalom had just been killed, When the revolt was finished, Siva, the one put in charge of the staff of 35 to serve Mephibosheth, spoke a terrible slander against Mephibosheth, that Mephibosheth remained in Yerushalayim, hoping that David and Avshalom would kill each other, and that the Malchus, the kingdom, would revert back to the son of Shaul, and he would be king. Nonsense. Nonsense. It's fascinating when Shabbos Daf Nun Hey, after the Gemara goes through hoops, absolving David of every single possible infraction when it comes to Bathsheba. Nonetheless, listen to this morality here. Nonetheless, holds David guilty of accepting Lashon Hara from Ziva. I'll absolve you for adultery. I'll absolve you from what looks like murder. The prophet says the sword that you used to kill Uriah, he blames it on him for ordering the death of Uriah to the Ammonites. But that same Gemara, the same two lines later, says, but David, we will not forgive you for accepting the Lashon Hara against Mephibosheth from Ziba. Okay? So at first, David told Ziba, you know what? That rat, after all I did for him, you take the field, it's yours. Now when Mephibosheth finally presents himself to David, right? And David asks him, so why did you remain in Yerushalayim? Right? It's true what I heard about you. He goes, David, I have no claims on you. You've been so kind to me. Just the happiness of me seeing that you survived this revolt. I don't need anything else. I have no claims. All I'm trying to do is to preserve my reputation with you. I have no claims. I'm not asking for anything. All I ask is that you take it out of your heart that I sided with Avshalom against you. David said, leave my sight. I don't want to hear anything more from you. If you want, split the field. Split the field. Split the property with Ziva. Right? Chazal said Ziva wasn't even Jewish, by the way. Got that? So split the field with Ziva. So a heavenly voice comes out and says, as soon as David said, split the field, what does the heavenly voice say?
Split kingdom, the kingdom.
Split
the kingdom. Right. And that is, it seems, the impetuosity that goes to David's psak of so quickly using his unconditional and unquestioned power to determine who owns this field. In truth, David owns it. But David, I expect more of you. You're the father of Mashiach. I expect more than impetuosity from you. So the same kind of misuse of power takes place in our Haftorah, I submit to you. This is what connects the Parshas Miketz, not just the dream, not just by Yikatz and Miketz. Yosef does the same. Whether Yosef's actions are predicated on him trying to do what I mentioned last week, to make sure that his nevuah, the nevuah of his dreams, would unequivocally come true, that's the Ramban. It's crucial. It's crucial so that everything he explains about dreams, from Paro's dreams to his own, becomes history, becomes part of our collective experience here in Egypt. Or, more like a bravonel, if you will, that Yosef wants to manipulate the situation to help them do a tshuva gemura, to an absolute tshuva, according to the Rambam in the beginning of Perek Beis of Hilchos Tshuva, that you need to have the same situation at hand that you had before. In this case, where a favored son of Yaakov or another son of Rachel can possibly be left behind, where you have to go home now and explain to your father that he's missing. Think you could do that again? How did you do it the first time? I wasn't there for that. Right?
He held back Binyamin.
Right, so this time the brothers may justify it. I mean, who told them to take the cup? Right? The first time, they were 100% responsible for it, of course. And they had to go and tell Yaakov that Yosef is not with us. Right? Whose code is this? So Yosef needs to put them into the same situation, maybe even a more complicated situation, for them to be fully redeemed. Okay, you get it? So that I go along with the Bravanel, but even if he's true, if he's correct, he should have recognized sometime before that this was indeed the case. He should have recognized. You shouldn't have put them through all this. And shouldn't have he had got some kind of message to his father in 9 years? What, was he angry that his father never sent any delegation to find him? Right? Yosef never knew what story the brothers told their father. Right? In truth, I'm not sure that Yosef even knows that the brothers know that he was sold. Explain what I mean by that.
Oh, he was taken out of the pit. He doesn't know what the brothers knew about the caravans.
Correct. Because while Rashi says that the object of the verb, they pulled him out of the pit, is the brothers, that is not the pshat. Pshat is that they went to eat something, and then when they returned, the Midianites had already pulled them out. They saw the Ishmaelim from far, and before the Ishmaelim had a chance to come, to whom they wanted to sell, right?
Because they were the brokers.
Right, that's Ramban. Yeah. Ibn Ezra says a simpler answer, that the Ishmaelim and Midianim are
the same,
are similar, are interchangeable. Like in some other places in Tanakh. But the brothers were never involved in the sale. Why didn't the rabbis tell that to Hadrian in the Yom Kippur story? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You know, when he wanted 10 rabbis to take the place of the 10 brothers. It turns out the 10 brothers never sold him. And why did Yosef say in the beginning of next week's parasha, Ani Yosef Hashemachartem Osi? I'm Yosef, whom you sold to the Egyptians.
Sold?
How would you explain that?
Huh. He must have thought that they contacted, said, oh, you know, go over there to that pit, give me money, and we've got a slave for you.
Yeah, it could be also that I'm Yosef, you were responsible for my being sold to Egypt.
That's for sure.
Right? So,
he probably had enough dreams. he dreamt a lot. Maybe he had a dream that he was sold. Also, he didn't.
No. The Bible tells it as narrative. But okay, so when Yosef wants to, if let's say Yosef wants to rehabilitate the brothers, this connection to this Haftorah maintains that he went too far. He made it go on too long. He extended the suffering of his father too long. The brothers, maybe they deserve to being raked over the coals in this story. Let's say it that way. You ever see the Gemara in Daf Tes and Maseches Tainis, where Reish Lakish's son acts with a little arrogance to Rav Yochanan, and Rav Yochanan cites a pasuk in Malachi where the boy says, hey, I'm just 3 years old. If I was older, I would have known this pasuk in Malachi, and I wouldn't have needed you, and I wouldn't have needed you, Oshaya, your Rebbe, who taught this pasuk. So Rav Yochanan, you know, thought he was a bit smart aleck. Oh, you know the Torah, huh? Okay, so how about this? I'll give you a pasuk in Mishlei. I'll give you a pasuk in the Nevi'im Ksuvim, and you tell me where this is hinted in the Torah. So I'll paraphrase the pasuk. It's, the Rasha makes his own problems, and then he blames God on the result of his problems. Where is that in the Torah? So it could be 5 or 6 different cases. But the case the boy came up with right away is in Parshas Miketz. Remember where this food distributor in Egypt starts to give them trouble, right? What was the initial reaction of the brothers? Why is God doing this to us? You made this problem, guys. This is your problem. It's you are making. I may not know it fully yet, but it's your problem. So But Yosef seems to be taking it too far. So when Shlomo behaves like David to split the baby, how dare you make a room for gasping people to think that you would actually cut a human being in half? Right? And so that also that Shlomo's son would act in a similarly impetuous manner when offered to lower taxes and submit to the people's will. So he behaves also in an impetuous manner. Yes, Camille?
Why didn't Shlomo just say share custody? Let one mother take care of the kid and let the other one take care of it. And if it proves that one will take better care of the child, then let that one have it. But if both of them take equally good care of the child, then let them let both of them care for the child.
I appreciate your judicious response. I think that Shlomo saw through what one of them was there for, and recognized that this is he knew what they did for a living, and he recognized that it was more to just what are we going to do about bringing up this baby. But I close with the following. That the connection is that it's all about the challenge in the Torah reading to this misuse of power. It should be obvious that the Malchus should go to Yosef. He's the one acting as king. He rose to be king. The brothers are bowing to him, for goodness sakes. It was all part of his dream. So obvious that Yaakov should make Yosef the ruler of the other tribes. He does give Yosef the birthright by giving him two tribes, but he prefers Yehuda because Yehuda makes tough decisions. He convinces people. But he's good at convincing people. And he's the one who challenges this misuse of power. Right? So the Malchus does not go to the one who misuses the power, but to the one who challenges it. That I submit to you is why this Haftarah of Miketz, one of the rarest of Haftarahs that we'll read this Shabbos, was reserved for this story. Okay? All right, Chevra. Next week we have another beautiful Haftarah from Yechezkel. Yechezkel is making his debut in the Torah. So far we haven't had a single Haftarah from Yirmiyahu. Nothing from Yahushua, nothing from Shoftim. Nothing from Shmuel. Okay? It's been heavily, heavily weighted towards Shehu Tracer. Okay, outside of those three books, there's only one Haftorah in all of Bereishis.
Rabbi, and also you have 25 participants.
Oh. Oh, how nice.
That's good.
Thank you.
That's good.
Love to each one of you. Okay, have a good night, everybody. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.
And Wednesday.
Be safe, everybody.